Today, from vaccine optimism to a third wave of COVID-19, how will we ever get out of this pandemic? Jill T runs a music festival.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Black Deer Festival was founded in 2016.
She'd worked in live events forever and knew exactly what she wanted to do when she started on her own.
It was the whole Americana roots and country music scene, because I felt that in the UK it hadn't really been given the platform it should have.
With a long-term colleague, Debs Schilling, Jill headed to Nashville, Tennessee, to recruit talent.
Oh my God, you just can't begin to imagine what it felt like for Debs and I. It was incredible, incredible.
Some of the artists that we champion and bring to the UK are, you know, artists that we found in dive bars in Nashville. There's a trace
of the way I used to feel about you. And the festival thrived. Thousands of people go every year.
It's an amazing melting pot of real music sung by real musicians from the heart. There's a saying that describes it, which is three chords and the truth.
This week, Jill and Debs were meant to be putting the finishing touches to the festival site, ready to welcome music fans on Friday for a weekend of everything from banjos to gospel choirs. After having to cancel in 2020, they were so relieved it was going ahead.
The party feeling that was around everyone, the joy in our suppliers just coming to site, working again. Don't forget, a lot of these guys hadn't worked on a live gig for a long, long time. So the excitement was building and building and building.
But it was not to be. When restrictions were extended to July the 19th, they had to cancel the whole thing.
My tears that I cried were genuine.
Perhaps the unluckiest was one of the artists they discovered in Nashville 5 years ago.
Oh, his name's Dylan Earl. He flew in the morning we were told that we wouldn't be able to go ahead. So you can imagine the disappointment.
Jill and Debs are not the only ones disappointed and confused. Instead of a summer of freedom, the news now is once again of rising COVID cases, despite the breakneck pace of vaccinations in the UK. So many people had hoped this phase was over. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what will it really take to get us out of this pandemic? Sarah Bosley, Guardian Health Editor. We've just heard from two women who, because cases are rising again and restrictions have been extended, have had to cancel their music festival last minute. It's a huge blow to their livelihoods and all the other businesses involved in that event and thousands others like them across the country. This has happened despite Britain having one of the world's longest lockdowns and fastest vaccination programmes. And Boris Johnson, until now, was really positive about the idea of normality returning.
We can really look at that June 21st date with some optimism.
What has gone wrong?
Basically, the Delta variant has gone wrong. So that's the mutation of the virus that's come from India in the first place. It's now called Delta, and it has taken over. So it's the dominant strain in this country. So this is rampaging. It's more transmissible. We think between 40 and 80% more transmissible. So a lot more people are getting infected.
Now, the Delta variant of coronavirus doubles the risk of hospitalization compared to the Alpha variant, which has been
and
dominant.
This means rates of pretty much doubled since last week.
Mr. Hancock said increased transmissibility was making the decision on whether to lift all remaining restrictions in England on the 21st of June more difficult.
And that's worrying. It is worrying mostly not because of the people who are being infected going to hospital, and certainly not because of deaths, because that's not rising very fast. It's mostly worrying because we've got a great deal of virus around at that rate of transmission, which means it's possible that some of the people who are vulnerable will get ill, and also that we could actually develop variants of our own again.
There is some concern about new mutations evading the vaccines. Is there any evidence of that so far?
Yes, we have seen that. And we've seen it with some of the previous variants that we've had concerns about. Not so much with the Kent variant, the UK variant, which is now called Alpha. That one was certainly spreading much faster than we'd known before, but it didn't have the nasty mutations. However, the beta and gamma variants, as we now call them, which came out of South Africa and Brazil, respectively, did have mutations that made the vaccines less effective. And these were mutations in the spike protein itself, which the vaccine actually targets. All the vaccines do at the moment. There's a particular mutation called E484K, which seemed to be causing much of the problem. However...
Eek.
Eek. Yeah, that's right, eek. However... we have seen that the vaccines are not completely knocked out by that at all. They do work. They just work slightly less well than they did before.
And beyond that, vaccination programmes are being hailed as the saviour, not least because in the early days, we got one after another suddenly being approved, and they each seem to outdo each other with these crazily high efficacy rates.
This is great. 70%, 75% keeps you out of the hospital, keeps you from dying. So
we are really excited about what this could mean for patients, and we're working very closely to Operation Warp Speed.
This is a vaccine efficacy of 95%.
And yet, here we are in the summer of 2021, facing some more weeks of restrictions. Were we wrong to be so optimistic, to feel like we'd be bulletproof?
I think there was massive relief when these hugely successful vaccines came along. So people did assume that it was just a case of let's give everybody a shot and we're out of this. And maybe that was a wrong perception only because unless you've got 100% vaccine, there are going to be some people who are still vulnerable. And actually, there are a lot of people in the country to vaccinate, of course. So certainly with two shots. So yes, I guess we probably were a little bit over-optimistic, or at least we thought the job would be done sooner than it will. And of course, also, we hadn't really anticipated the problem with the variants. And I'm talking about we, the public, as opposed to people like Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance, who probably knew perfectly well that these problems would come along.
But, you know, this virus has taken us by surprise time and time again, and we just don't know.
So perhaps we have been a little over-enthusiastic about it. On the other hand, these are fantastic vaccines and they certainly are the route out. We've already seen that the link between cases and hospitalizations and deaths has been at least partly severed. I think it's been completely severed myself. But the big issue for me and actually, for all of us, is that the world is not being vaccinated. The UK is way ahead of the curve, and the US is as well. What we have to worry about is that the rest of the world is getting a tiny share of these vaccines, and a very tiny proportion of people are being protected against the disease, which means that the virus is just going to spread and spread in those countries. And variants will develop. That's how they develop, because where you have a lot of virus around, they are able to evolve more easily.
So knowing that we need to vaccinate the world to protect all of us from this pandemic, what were the plans to make that happen?
The big plan has always been COVAX. And this initiative aims to buy vaccines to give to the poorer countries, largely, who can't afford to get them for themselves. So that's the initiative. It's obviously a great thing to do. It's a really important thing to do, but it's underfunded and it's got nowhere like the number of doses of vaccine that it needs at the moment.
When you say it's got nowhere near enough, what do you mean? How far behind is it?
So COVAX has delivered 87 million doses so far, but their target is for 2 billion by the end of this year. So they're running pretty short. And that means that some countries have only got tiny amounts.
That sounds like an absolute mountain to climb. Let's talk about what has gone wrong so far. Obviously, we've discussed before the fact that India was going to be a big provider to COVAX and then had its own really terrible crisis that it had to deal with.
Bodies piling up in crematoriums, graveyards running out of space.
Patients are being turned away. There is a severe shortage of oxygen and even drugs used to treat COVID infections.
And the situation in India is beyond heartbreaking.
But beyond that, what is going on? Can I ask you first about the companies themselves? Is there a problem with production?
They have actually all had production problems. You know, these are biological compounds. They are things that have to be grown in great vats, and you know, it's a complicated process. So for the AstraZeneca vaccine in particular, there have been lots of supply problems, simply because the vaccine hasn't grown in the quantities they expected in some of the factories. The Netherlands, for instance, had a particular issue there. And the AstraZeneca vaccine is the big one that we were expecting was going to be the workhorse of COVAX and really go out to a lot of developing countries. But actually, the mRNA vaccines have also had production problems. So it's not unique to AstraZeneca by any means. It's just that you can't just turn the tap on and off with these.
And what about richer countries that have done very well at vaccinating their own populations? Are they causing problems for others? Are they hoarding doses?
Yes, that's certainly what a lot of campaigners say, and even the WHO is saying that.
What we're seeing now globally is not what we had hoped for. So we first, not me first, is the only way to end the pandemic. Vaccine hoarding by countries will only prolong the ordeal and delay recovery for Africa and also for the whole world. It would be deeply unjust if the most vulnerable Africans were forced to wait for vaccines while lower risk population subgroups in wealthier countries are made safe.
Yes, they are very intent on getting their populations completely protected first. And I think everybody recognises that that's sort of what politicians are elected to do. So it's actually a bit difficult. But there is this other argument that if we don't protect people in other countries, then we're going to have a bigger problem ourselves.
And everyone knew that when the G7 leaders met in Cornwall this month, that this was number one on the in tray. Did they manage to come up with something?
Well, yes, they did.
I'm very pleased to announce that this weekend, leaders have pledged over 1 billion doses, either directly or through funding to COVAX. That includes 100 million from the UK to the world's poorest countries.
But firstly, it's not enough. So the UK is going to share 100 million doses and the US 500 million doses. And there will be some from the others as well. It's not enough in the scale of need, and it's also going to take too long. UK is talking about within 12 months. Well, actually, the need is immediate. You know, the sooner you can get people vaccinated, the sooner you start to reduce the amount of virus there is in other countries. So even the Director General of the World Health Organization has been saying this, you know, it actually isn't enough in spite of all the enthusiastic rhetoric that there was in Cornwall at the G7.
Okay, so the G7 haven't done quite enough. This problem is huge. Until it's sorted, everyone is going to continue to be at risk from this pandemic. What can they do to try to solve this?
The key thing is to get more doses of vaccine made, and preferably to get them made all around the world. We need more manufacturing facilities, and there are lots of countries that have never manufactured vaccines. There are countries that have got vaccine plants, and some of those in Asia and in Latin America have actually been signed up by AstraZeneca, who have given them the recipe and the technology and given them the license to go ahead. So you are getting some doses made in other parts of the world. It's not just down to Europe and the US. The only problem is that that's a slow process and there still aren't enough. Really, we need vaccine plants to be set up in countries that don't have any. And that would be very good for now and also for the future as well.
So are there ideas about ways of ramping production up any faster?
There's been a lot of campaigning for the patents to be waived on these vaccines. That means the companies that have got at least 20 years of IP, intellectual property rights, over these vaccines, which gives them lots of profits because nobody else can make the vaccine while they have that IP right. They would actually waive that. They would say that any company in the world can make this vaccine in the public interest. So that would be a good thing, but you still need those vaccine manufacturing plants. Otherwise, if you haven't got the capacity, it doesn't help. Those two things really have to go hand in hand. It would also enable the prices to be pushed right down, because part of the reason that Big Pharma likes its patents is that they can charge what they like while they actually have the monopoly on production. Clearly, if these vaccines are being made everywhere, that there's competition in that and the price goes down.
And on patents, first of all, why would a company agree to that if they've come up with the product in the first place? And secondly, Joe Biden recently agreed to this, didn't he? So why hasn't it happened?
So there's been a very long-running battle over patents for medicines, and now that is moving into the vaccines as well. And that goes back to the AIDS drugs in the late 90s. We wanted to be able to treat Africans, and the actual drug combinations that were saving lives in America and in Europe were hugely expensive. So eventually what happened was that the companies did refuse to budge, but Indian generics companies, that's companies that make copycat medicines, if you like, they found a loophole in the law in India, which allowed them to make these drug combinations, even though they were under patent, and then sell them to Africa. So that was great, but the battle has been fierce because drug companies want to preserve their monopolies, obviously. And from the very first time that they allow that to slip, there is a precedent. So now the same thing's happening with the vaccines. The only difference I can see now is that there isn't the manufacturing capacity for vaccines that there was with drugs. So that does make things a little bit more difficult.
And what about in the short term? I mean, can money not solve this? Would it just be a huge burden on rich countries to vaccinate the world?
Money is only useful if the vaccines are there to buy. So yes, we can get a lot of vaccines into the arms of people in the developing world if we start diverting some of the supplies that we're taking ourselves over to Africa and Asia. And that probably is the answer for them in the short term. That does mean that we're just going to have to wait a little bit longer before, for instance, we vaccinate all the children. You know, there is a trade-off here. You can't just do it all at the same time.
Okay, so Sarah, those are the problems we've got in getting vaccines out to parts of the world. But I want to ask you about the vaccines more generally as a solution and as a solution in the future. How effective are they right now? And do we think that they're going to continue to be effective against further mutations of COVID-19?
They are very effective. The efficacy has been diminished a bit by these variants. But if you think about it, what we're really trying to do is to protect people from ending up in hospital, severely ill in intensive care, and from dying. Now, on those counts, they do amazingly well. And even if you look at the Delta variant that we've got now, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is 96% effective against people going into hospital after two doses. And the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine is 92% after two doses. So they absolutely score on the thing that we're trying to do, the main event, which is to, as I say, to save lives. Where they're not quite so good is at preventing people from getting either symptomatic illness, which where they perhaps just stay at home, or in fact asymptomatic illness where they don't even know that they've got it. And that's where you get an awful lot of transmission going around. And of course, that affects very much the younger age group who socialise a lot. And so they are more likely actually to spread it amongst themselves and to other people who haven't been vaccinated.
This does kind of feel like the greatest clinical trial the world has ever been through, clearly with some amazing results. Have we been able to compare the vaccines in that time?
I think the answer is yes and no on that. It's a bit like a head-to-head trial, except it isn't, because you can't compare exactly the sorts of people that you've got. If you think about it, the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, because it's got some side effects that appear to hit the younger people more, is not being given in the UK to the under 40s. It's not being given at all in the United States. And in Europe, there are various restrictions as well. So you can't anymore really compare that to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, for instance, which is being used in pretty much everybody. So it would be a bit wrong to say that one is better than the other. Obviously, for younger people, it is far better to get a Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine or a Moderna vaccine and just sidestep the risk of blood clots with low platelets, which is the side effect that we've seen in AstraZeneca and also in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
And obviously, there are other factors at play here, like you might get slightly higher efficacy figures for one vaccine over another. But then there's another side to that, which is how much they cost and how easy they are to store. How important is that when we're thinking about getting them out across the world?
Oh, this is fundamentally important, I think. In fact, the efficacy rates, when you come down to things like hospitalisation, there's very little in it, in fact. It's a few percentage points, which may sound significant to us, but they're not in the scale of things. The cost and the ease of use are absolutely crucial as far as the poorer countries of the world are concerned. And that's why so many hopes were pinned to the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. The scientists at Oxford always maintained that that was their intention, to make a vaccine that the whole world could use.
Sarah, what you're describing is a huge challenge. Vaccinating individual countries is incredibly difficult. Rolling vaccines out to the entire world is clearly going to be very tough and take time. Without that, we can obviously expect more variants like the one we're seeing surging in Britain today. So are you essentially saying that we have to accept that this pandemic will continue, even if the crisis is not quite as severe as it has been up to now?
What we do know for sure is that we're going to have to live with this virus because it will not go away. It's not like smallpox. We cannot eradicate it. And we won't do that because it's a respiratory virus. There's so much of it about. It's so transmissible. So it's very, very hard to get rid of, and we won't achieve it. So I think Chris Whitty the other day actually said we're going to have to live with this virus for the rest of our lives.
COVID is not going to go away. That yeah. this is now a disease that for the rest of our careers is going to be around. So it is clear that, you know, we are going to have to manage it at some point, rather like we manage flu. And I think when you say that, people then jump and say you think it's flu. Well, it's not flu, it's a completely different disease. But the point I'm making is, here is a seasonal, very dangerous disease that kills thousands of people every year, and society has chosen a particular way around it.
That is true. What we have to guard against is the arrival of mutations, variants that are going to cause a lot of deaths and illness. Hopefully, that's not going to happen because we'll get up to levels of herd immunity where it won't. But we just have to think in terms of what we do and also our global citizenship. It is extremely important that we sort it for the whole world as well as ourselves.
Coming up, as COVID-19 is not going away, what does that mean for people like Debs and Jill? For Jill and Debs, the festival organisers, the delay in lifting restrictions has been a tough financial blow.
It was just a massive, just slap. when we heard, well, we've lost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds.
And I think the thing that really is the most upsetting is that we'd put every measure in place for the safety of our staff, our suppliers, our customers and our artists. So just beggars belief, really.
The pair understand that COVID cases are rising and they want to see people's health protected. That's why they had put those measures in place. But this decision came quite late and they really don't feel that all events have been targeted equally.
We're still really raw about what's happened, and for us to, you know, open our news feeds in the morning and see those masses of people and crowds at Ascot, and, you know, the crowds pouring out of Wembley after, you know, one of the football games, it's just beyond us. We just don't understand how it's come to this.
They feel like ministers aren't thinking about people like them and the impact this has had on their industry.
I just felt furious seeing those pictures, seeing our industry being decimated. You know, the industry that I've been in for a long, long time, and I love from the bottom of my heart, I love the people in it. It's an incredible industry to be in, and to see what's happening is criminal. And watching what's going on now, I'd love to sit in front of some of these decision makers and look them in the eye and actually ask how they can justify this. That's how I feel. I really feel angry, actually.
They're trying to be positive. They've already started planning next year's festival. They've scrambled to find gigs for that musician, Dylan Earle, who ended up stranded here. But it's a bleak time for live music.
We were the first to close and we're being the last to open up. And when you walk around the average high street or go anywhere now, life is normal. In the events industry, life isn't normal. It really isn't. And I've seen such pain and hardship for so many suppliers and people in this industry that it's going without being given the right amount of exposure. I really do feel that. I think it's terribly, terribly sad.
That was Jill T and Deb Schilling of Black Deer Festival and The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley. At the start of this episode, you heard some brilliant music from The Dead South and Dylan Earle. Do follow all our reporting on COVID-19 with our health, science and politics teams. Do also subscribe to the Science Weekly podcast and check out John Harris's column this week on the people like Jill and Debs really suffering. It's called Summer Festivals Are Crying Out for Help, but the Tories don't want to hear it. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alice Fordham. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.